1. It's 11:07.
Major funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is a special edition of The Connection. We're continuing our coverage this morning, looking at September 11th, 2001, from the vantage point of 1 year on. And 1 year ago, this hour, this is what we heard.
We crashed in a small rural area. Details are still sketchy on it. It was near Shanksville, Pennsylvania, which is near...
In terms of the potential number of casualties, this is an unprecedented attack in the United States.
American Airlines says it lost two aircraft carrying 156 people.
I'm standing, Bob, right in front of the Pentagon where the aircraft hit. I've been drafted as a litter bearer, and there are a bunch of volunteer teams here who are organized around litter bearing, and we're about to be drafted to go in and pick up injured.
The great irony here is that the command and control center, the emergency crisis center set up by the city of New York, was in the World Trade Center.
We saw the World Trade Center bomb. Next thing I know, they see a building behind the Capitol. Then they see the Pentagon, and oh my God, that's too close for comfort.
Memorials are continuing across the country, around the world today, everywhere from Shanksville, Pennsylvania, where this music was recorded earlier today. It's Aaron Copland's Fanfare for the Common Man. To New York, where the names continue to be read, to the Pentagon, to Laconia, New Hampshire, where there's a candlelight ceremony at Endicott Park Beach later today. With us this hour, Reverend Nathan D. Baxter, Dean of Washington's National Cathedral, and Michael Ignatieff. He's director of Harvard's Carr Center for Human Rights and author of a number of books, among them The Warrior's Honor, Ethnic War, and The Modern Conscience. We will also be touching base with America's poet laureate, Billy Collins, and we'd like to hear from you. Your reflection on September 11th, 2001-2002. Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And I should perhaps observe, maybe a little bit unfairly, that when Copland's Fanfare of the Common Man came blasting in there, I got almost a wince across the table from Michael Ignatieff.
Oh, it's terribly moving stuff. And it's a day when music... does a better job than words, and the words that really matter are the names that are read out. Each one of those names are the words that really count.
A little bit earlier today, Dean Baxter, you were with Archbishop Desmond Tutu at a service.
Yes, we were.
A thought from you just on what an anniversary like this either means to you or is supposed to mean.
Well, I think that certainly the most intimate part of a day like today for all of us as Americans is a time when we do remember those who were lost and the sorrow that still exists in a very intimate way for many people who have lost loved ones and family members and very close colleagues, as well as for us as a nation having lost a sense of perceived invincibility. I think a lot of our grief is around that experience as well. I think that what we have tried to do in the services here at this cathedral, beginning last night and will continue all the way through till this evening, is to also lift up that in some way we have recognized our membership in a world that's suffering in many ways, that what was for us on September the 11th, 01, is a daily occurrence in the lives of people in many parts of the world. And so that we are not only not alone in our grief, but we are and must not be alone as we seek ways to create peace to stand against terrorism. We must hold hands.
Michael, you spent a good part of your summer traveling abroad. The the idea that Dean Baxter's talking about, that there is a whole other world out there that may go through this sort of thing on a more regular basis. Were there people who were saying that, who wanted to make that point in conversations with you about September 11th?
Well, I think there's a difference between the suffering and pain of hunger and oppression and disease and premature death, the kind of suffering that is the lot of billions of human beings around the globe, and this premeditated attack that claims 3,000 lives. I understand what Dean Baxter is saying, and I deeply respect it, but I think we ought to distinguish types and forms of suffering.
Okay, let's be more clear. If you're a resident of Karachi, if you live in Kashmir, if you're in one of these parts of the world that is a flashpoint, certainly anywhere in the Middle East.
That's to what I'm referring
right.
to. I think the conditions which make people vulnerable to terrorist alliances have to be addressed. I think the things you're talking about in terms of the human condition, what I was identifying is sometimes it's very difficult when you are a wealthy and powerful nation to identify with the suffering of sustenance of other people. But I think what this did is it at least helped us to identify with those who do on a regular basis experience the acts of terrorism, whether it is in Rwanda or whether it is in Palestine or in Israel, or there are a lot of flashpoints, and I think that's what Desmond Tutu wanted to call to our attention today. But I do agree, if I understand you correctly, that we also have a greater responsibility to take our place as a nation to address issues of hunger, of poverty, the AIDS epidemic, that's pandemic now throughout the world. I think that's a deeper question, an issue to which we have to take a more responsible account.
I think that's certainly true. I think what's painful and difficult about this day, however, is that there's no way around what the president said at the Pentagon a couple of hours ago. This plane flew into the Pentagon and killed Americans. It didn't kill other people. It killed Americans. And so there is, I think, a kind of two things are happening. On the one hand is a sense of tremendous solitude, I think, that can't be denied. Americans were attacked, and Americans, in any moment when you've been attacked, when you've suffered loss, when you've suffered trauma, what follows after trauma and suffering is solitude, a sense that you're alone. And I think it's one of the things that I felt slightly disturbed about in Europe in the summer is that there was solidarity. Let's not pretend there was deep solidarity, deep fellow feeling for Americans. But there is also an undeniable feeling it happened to you. It didn't happen to us. Mm. And this is the pitiless character of what happened. And we can't ignore it. There is some sense also in a policy terms, and this is perhaps not the day to talk about policy, in which United States policy has contributed to isolate the United States more than it might have been after September 11th. But this feeling of solitude, the feeling that Americans have that they're alone, that it's high noon, they're in the corral alone, there's nobody else in there, and they're facing an enemy alone, is, I think, just beneath the surface of a lot of rhetoric that says, we now understand the sufferings of the rest of the world. The rest of the world understands us in a different way than they did before September 11th.
Except for the people reflecting on that here in this country, it is in part a recognition of the price of being the superpower, the one superpower.
Yes, and I think it's very important not to feel sentimental about this sense of solitude. I think some of the solitude that Americans may feel on a day like this just goes with power. It's just the way it is. It's not nice, but that's the way it is.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going to Nashville, Tennessee, and Armando's called in. Hi, Armando.
Hi, thank you very much for this great show. All of you are touching on exactly what I've been aware of today. I thought I would not watch TV today, would just let it go because I've been so tied up with all of this over the last year, and I was just so struck, though, by the contrast between how New York seems to be observing today and Washington, D.C. at the Pentagon. At the Pentagon, it all comes down to the U.S. as power represented by military and the U.S. as oneness. And in New York, you had a sense of more multicultural concept of the U.S. as a bunch of different people coming together, and the strength is from the shared, you know, how we relate, say, on the street or something. but they were just so totally different.
Let me turn to Dean Baxter on that, because he's joining us from Washington. I'm curious to know whether or not that the observation that Armando has is something that you saw or aware of. Or
I'm aware of the planning for the Pentagon service, though I did not, of course, attend because we had our service here at the National Cathedral. However, I think his observations are accurate in the sense that there's a different culture around the Pentagon. The Pentagon really is a center of the polis, of the political state, of the military state. And that culture focuses much more on people who have come together because they understand themselves to be a symbol of the nation's defense. I think New York, the Trade Center, but more largely the community around that and the magnitude of the numbers, which are so much greater than in Arlington and the D.C. area, is really more about a community of people, and I think they're responding in that way. I'd like to take one more step on that whole matter, though, because I think that not only this has been about solitude in one way or another, whether it is looking at it from a more political and military perspective or looking at it as a community, is that we have become more mindful of our diversity. In my travels, in my 11 years working here at the National Cathedral and around the nation in that capacity, I have sensed a greater consciousness that America is not a European monolith, but that this is a country in culture, in race, in religion, and even in nationality that is extremely diverse. And I think we had an awareness of that, but an awareness that we sought to come together across those lines. And we tried to represent that in the services here at the cathedral, by having representation from many cultures in American life and many religions that we might share together in the integrity of our experiences individually, but also our common concern. Finally, the fact that persons lost were also nationals of other countries. It was not just an American tragedy. We carried the flags of 30-some nations who lost nationals in these strikes, and we invited the ambassadors of their countries to be present. So that I think that as I talk to Americans, and we went through the planning for this service, I think many people are experiencing not only their grief, but a solitude in a way in which they realize we are much more diverse as a nation than we have been willing to acknowledge, or at least conscious of, in the past.
Armando, back to you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call. Michael, when Armando was talking about the contrast between Washington and New York, I was thinking of your own writing in a book that I mentioned earlier in the program, The Warrior's Honor, because in part there is the warrior's response and then there is the personal response. And they are distinct, but they end up having to operate under some kind of a single purpose. They don't always fit well together.
Well, it's the two faces of America. I mean, this is the world's superpower. And it, as a superpower, I think what Dean Baxter said at the beginning, at the top, is very true. One of the meanings of September 11th is the loss of perceived invincibility at that moment. The other side of America, the America that's much, much easier to love and that almost everybody loves, that is the multicultural, brawling babble of tongues that is New York and that is everything that everybody always loves about America.
Yeah.
But those two go together.
Hola! Home!
Okay, no problem.
It's in a way hard to keep reminding ourselves that it was this hour 1 year ago. Certainly this hour 1 year ago, both towers were down and the four planes had crashed. But, you know, to look at the timeline of what was happening there, it was almost exactly this time that American Airlines officially reported that it had lost two aircraft and that United Airlines was busy putting together its own effort to try and figure out what had happened, and it reminds us of the confusion of that time, if nothing else. But Bob in Cape Cod, I interrupted you on your story. I want you to pick it up if you can.
Howard, I found out, was a rocket scientist. I knew he had got his PhD from Columbia and taught there. And I knew of his love for numbers, but there I didn't realize his genius as a man. And Howard lived, as I said, three houses on one way. David Pruham, three houses the other way. Because of the numbers that he was involved with, and being on the 103rd floor and not being able to leave, this morning I said how great it is when I heard the radio, I'll be able to hear both of their names read on the radio or television. I will hear that. And of course, it started wonderfully, but then it would jump around to different stations, different areas. And I said, I'm not going to get to hear my friend's name.
Well, I'm
the K's all of a sudden did come up, and I heard Howard's name read. And then it went out again, and a short time later, for a very short time, David Pruin's name came up, and I heard his name read. And again, it was pulled away and went to some other area. And because of Howard and his love of numbers, it was such a laugh. He loved to laugh so. And it was so fitting that I heard both names in this short amount of time when they were pulling out and going into different stations. And again, hearing taps, it was, I can see his smile now. And that's basically all I wanted to say. How warm it's made me feel.
Oh, thanks for sharing that.
Well, I think that everybody listening will be very touched that you remembered your friends in this way.
Yes.
And I'll add a mea culpa for the mechanics of the business that we're in, because I know that there are people listening to the radio who didn't get a chance to listen to the names that they would have liked to hear. And I'll only say, Bob, that, you know, it's tough. You want to be in Washington, you want to be in Pennsylvania, and there's those snapping flags at ground zero and everything happening there. It's hard to decide where to be, and I know that some people feel that that they missed out. I'm glad that you called in with that comment. Thanks for being with us. Our number is 1-800-423-8255, and we're going next to... Where are we off to here? Hartford, Connecticut. Felix is on the line.
Yes, I'm Felix from Hartford, Connecticut.
Hey, Felix, thanks for calling in.
I couldn't believe I got through. You mentioned earlier the difference in the speeches at the Pentagon and in New York City, and, well, they were different, and how they come from different backgrounds and different nature. But one thing a lot of people fail to look at when they think of the military, it is the most diverse, and it's also the most unbiased organization that people can be in. In my unit, there were always people who would be speaking different languages in their off time. We had a Jamaican officer. We had people from South Africa and from Asia. They were from all over the place. It truly is the most diverse organization. And the nature of the speeches might have been different, but I think maybe the background of the speeches and where they were coming from, despite the different nature, may have been the same.
I think that's a very good point. Every experience I've ever had of the United States Armed Forces in any branch, and I was in Afghanistan in the summer and Bosnia as well, you see serving officers and men and women who represent the true tapestry of America. And it's an enormous source of strength, the American Armed Forces. And I'm glad you made the comment, Felix.
It is. In fact, I'm a Vietnam veteran and served in Vietnam. And I think that in some ways, the military was a place where many young women and men discovered diversity, not only racial and cultural and religious diversity, but regional diversity. We used to play a game of trying to figure out where a person was from by the way they spoke, not only accents, but their phraseologies. But I think that 9/11/01, though New York is so cosmopolitan and so is this Washington metropolitan area, but many places in the heartland, people began to realize that There were neighbors, there were mosques in their communities, there were neighbors who wore different garb or had a different religious or cultural experience. And I think that what has been true in the military, thanks to Harry Truman giving it diversity, I think is becoming a greater awareness. And I've discovered as I've traveled to places recently, such as Oklahoma and places in southern Florida and in Ohio and so on, that people are reaching out in small communities as well. And recognizing that, as John Philip Bailey said in his poem Festus, he said, "America, thou half-brother of the world, something good and something bad from every land." And I think that's becoming more and more a way in which we reaffirm the richness of our diversity.
Dean Baxter, a little earlier when the President, Secretary of Defense were speaking at the Pentagon, the television cameras were panning across the faces of the men and the women in uniform, and they illustrated just as lyrically as Felix did with his call, the diversity that exists there. And I don't think anybody could listen to what was happening there, watch what was going on there, and not feel the sense of that group, both as a collection of individuals but as one organization. I want to know whether or not, in your role, as this narrative shifts from a remembrance of September 11, 2001, to where the President wants to take us next, which is a speech at Battery Park, and then to the United Nations to make his case for yet another attack in a spiritual way, whether or not it's difficult for you, for people who come to the Washington National Cathedral, in terms of, you know, I'm just so on the page with what I was seeing at the Pentagon, but if I'm really uncomfortable with what's happening in Iraq, am I against those people?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I think that the truth of the matter is that there is evil in the world, and evil has to be resisted, and sometimes with force. I think the real issue before us as Americans is really two things, actually. One is we're trying to figure out what it means to be a superpower. I think the other guest, being a historian, would know better. But my sort of lay perception is that this is the first time that a great superpower has existed in a world that is so interdependent, that there is an autonomy that may have been for great superpowers in ages past, that we don't have that privilege anymore. And so the responsibility of not behaving unilaterally, but working at making sure that what we do, as much as is possible, is done with not only partnership, but being sensitive to the wisdom and insights of our partners in different parts of the world. I think that has strategic interests, not only moral interests, but I think there are strategic implications. So therefore, I think that the issue, particularly with regard to Iraq, I think it's a troubling situation. But the larger question is, has diplomacy truly been exhausted? And any actions that we take, do we set the right pattern? As we look at the equation of our own security and being a model for what unilateral actions can represent, are we acting responsibly? And I think that's the hard question. That's the hard question, as I would say, as a spiritual leader, is asking, what does it mean to be a superpower? Does it mean that we can act unilaterally? And I think that's part of what the President, I think, is struggling with. He says one thing publicly, but I know personally, in a conversation with him in this past week, that he does struggle with that.
Dean Baxter, thanks for being with us.
Indeed. Well, it's a pleasure, and God give us a safe and a meaningful day today. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That's the very Reverend Nathan D. Baxter, Dean of the Washington National Cathedral. We're going to the Pentagon, where Steve Inskeep, NPR reporter, is standing by. Hi, Steve.
Good to speak with you again, Dick.
I'm just, I gather that the formal part of the memorial service at the Pentagon is over now.
The formal part outside the building, outside the spot where the plane crashed into the building 1 year ago today, is over. There are other events through the day. American Airlines employees are here to have a memorial to the flight crew that was killed. Workers are being shown appreciation. The people who actually worked in the Pentagon site are being shown appreciation elsewhere. So the big communal gathering is over, but the commemoration is not.
And as you heard in my conversation with Dean Baxter, it's kind of a grinding of the gears here as we will switch in the latter part of today with a speech from the president later this evening and then tomorrow at the United Nations to what comes next.
It's interesting. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld already made a start on that, Dick. If you had a chance to hear his speech, it was he really had one of the few broader references here. President Bush certainly talked about vowing to win the war that began here with this strike at the Pentagon and the attack on the World Trade Center. But Secretary Rumsfeld had a warning. He said that unless terrorists are stopped, the light of history will fade from this day and turn its light to subsequent days when not thousands, but tens of thousands of lives could be lost. If you hear the defense secretary speak from time to time, it would be hard to miss what he's referring to there. This is a man who has argued fiercely that weapons of mass destruction could be used in the next terrorist attack, be it chemical, biological, or nuclear weapons. He, in turn, has argued that that threat is so grave that the United States needs to radically change its policies, that it needs to seriously consider whether to launch preemptive strikes against countries. And in turn, there you are thinking about Iraq, or at least the Bush administration is thinking in those terms at this time.
I think that the remarks by Rumsfeld are interesting, but you know, one of the real problems about September 11th as an anniversary is that it reminds us of how scared we were and how scared we still are. And being afraid and the condition of being afraid is a lousy basis on which to make policy. And I just feel that one of the things I'm concerned about today, tomorrow, and the next day is the ways in which the fear that we legitimately feel is going to be politically exploited to ratchet up and drive us into a war where it seems to me the case of Iraq has not been proven. The American people all over the world need to be treated like rational adults. They don't need to be scared into war. They need to be persuaded, argued with, talked to like sensible people. What is the case? Why now? Why there? A lot of people feel that with Osama bin Laden still walking around possibly in the border areas of Pakistan, going after Iraq is like changing the subject. It's the linkage between a war in Iraq and a war on terror is not obvious to a lot of American people. And don't hear me saying that I don't think Saddam is a danger. He's an evil despot. He has very dangerous weapons. But I have yet to hear a convincing case made to me and to other people that this is a war that we absolutely have to fight. And I'm worried that in the current context of remembrance, the context of fear, the context of replaying these images which send a chill right up our spine, we will cease to reason as citizens. And this is a moment when every American needs to reason and think calmly as a citizen, because 250,000 troops going into Iraq will be the most important display of force by the United States since the Second World War, and we better have very, very good reasons for doing so.
Let's check the tone of the message as it's coming from the executive. President Bush speaking at the Pentagon at about 10 o'clock this morning.
What happened to our nation on a September day set in motion the first great struggle of a new century. The enemies who struck us are determined, and they're resourceful. They will not be stopped by a sense of decency or a hint of conscience, but they will be stopped.
Steve Inskeep at the Pentagon. President Bush is not being specific in those remarks, whether or not he's talking just about Al-Qaeda, whether or not he's talking about the terrorism that began on September 11th in such dramatic fashion, or whether or not, you know, what he's referring to may in fact include, as Michael Ignatieff is referring to here in the studio, the next war, the war on Iraq. I know that certainly NPR has added extra muscle to its Washington team in anticipation of covering this.
Well, we're expecting something to happen. You can't say exactly what. It is interesting to hear Mr. Ignatieff point out that there is not necessarily an ironclad case against Iraq, that Iraq poses an imminent threat, a nuclear threat, or some other kind of dire threat to the United States. And it's been interesting to me to hear U.S. officials and also former officials and experts talk about this over the last few weeks. The point that U.S. officials have ended up landing in, Dick, is essentially saying that the United States needs to guard against the unknown, that we simply do not know what Iraq is up against. And I'm just sitting here thinking about it, and it kind of reminds me of the argument that has been made about so-called material witnesses in the United States. There's an awful lot of people in the United States since the last September 11 against whom you could not make a good criminal case, apparently, but that the United States government has decided to detain for any number of reasons. And now we have a situation where, on a global scale, the government is arguing that there may be a certain number of countries in the world and that Iraq would, in their view, be at the top of the list, that the regimes need to be taken into custody, so to speak. And they're arguing that the lack of knowledge of exactly what Iraq is up to should not necessarily stay in their way. It certainly is a novel argument. It can be seen as a very tenuous argument, but that's the argument that's being made.
Steve, thanks for being with us.
Happy to help.
Steve Inske, NPR's reporter. At the Pentagon this hour, and you can hear the flags of the wind at the tail end of the memorial service there in the background. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. To Raleigh, North Carolina now, and Terry's joining us. Hi, Terry.
Good afternoon.
Thanks for calling in.
Thank you for listening. I'm a Vietnam veteran. I was a mechanic in Vietnam. When a chopper would come in shot up, I knew whose blood was lost or whose life had been lost. The ultimate cost of freedom. America is reliving the trauma of 9/11 today. America has 250,000 homeless military veterans, men and women, World War II to 9/11/2002. We need not forget these people. They're dying on our streets to survive a war and die on the streets of America.
On a day like today, Terry, do you get a sense that the memory is too short, that the ability of either people, the media, the politicians to include, you know, what precedes September 11th is lost?
Of German situation, a sort of proto-fascist situation. I don't think it's as bad as that, but it's a bad thing when we have 1,200 detainees where the basic due process rights, the basic habeas corpus rights are suspended. It's a bad thing if we have an absence of due process in the handling of al-Qaeda detainees. This country runs on the rule of law. It's just crucial, I think, that citizens like the caller mobilize their fellow citizens to care deeply about this, support the ACLU, which fights a lonely fight on these issues. This is one of the places, I think, I was talking earlier about fear. This is one of the places where fear results in bad politics. There is a threat out there. There are some bad people who exploit the liberties in this country, but there is simply no justification for the clampdowns that we have seen and that are in process. And I'm particularly concerned, as I say, about the continued detention a year on of over 1,200 people on immigration violations and that kind of thing. This country is too big, too strong to stoop to low measures like that. And it's very important for citizens to raise their voice against it.
Mary, back to you.
Yes, I guess I'm... Two, that we're forgetting the reasons why the FBI and the CIA are separate agencies. I hate to sound too paranoid about it, but our government established those as separate agencies for a very specific reason. And it's placed some limitations on their operations, specifically to protect our civil liberties. And what I hear now coming from the president in particular is a desire to collapse that and to centralize the power. And I guess that worries me.
I want to thank you for your call, Mary.
Thank you.
To Malden, Massachusetts now. Deborah's on the line. Hi, Deborah.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you for having me on.
Your thoughts about September 11th, 2002, or 2001?
Yes. 2001. Last year, I was a rabbinic student studying in New York, and I remember vividly that very morning at about 7 o'clock waiting for my bus from Manhattan up to Riverdale. It was a beautiful morning, as everybody remembers. And I was sitting there reading the New York Times, which I infrequently bought while I was there. And looking around me, I was sitting right against Central Park, and it was beautiful. And I said, maybe New York is not so bad after all. I never really had liked the city very much. And then went up to school and started class, and we were sitting waiting for our teacher to come. And people kept coming into the classroom with pieces of horrible news. We all thought at first it was just a little plane that had crashed into one of the towers, which was terrible, but we didn't think disaster. And then one student after another came in, and we heard that the second tower had been hit, and then that the Pentagon had been hit, and then that the towers had collapsed. And at that point, the president of our school just called us all together and dismissed us from school and said, just get home to your families however you can.
And where are you, not physically, but what are you thinking today?
Well, I'm, of course, living in the memory of that day again and fleeing from New York like a refugee to get home, desperately trying to reach my family and tell them that I was okay. And that was almost impossible to do. And I was just living through that again. You know, I was so close to it, but enough out of it to get away and to drive for the next 4 hours listening to the radio, just in horror at what was going on.
One of the things that Michael has written about, writes about, is Freud's introductory lectures on psychoanalysis, the difference between knowing and knowing. And I'm wondering, as you apply that to where we are 1 year later, whether or not that's not in part a useful way of getting at it.
Dick, that's a very interesting thought, really. You can know something in your head, you can know something in your brain, and then there's another kind of knowing that's much deeper, knowing it in your guts. I hear the caller saying she knows something in her guts. It takes a very, very long time to work some of this through. I don't think I want to get into the language of therapy. We don't need therapy. We need good public policy. We need calm, reflective judgment by citizens. But I think 9/11 is one of those things which you can know at one level and not know at another. And we've all been through a year where we've tried to move it from something that we saw with our eyes, heard with our ears, into some much deeper knowing. And I think that's the sense in which the world changed. We've had to struggle with this deeper knowing, this deeper processing of an experience that convulsed, I think, every one of us. And that's why an earlier caller touched us so much with his memories of his neighbors. That's the kind of day we're going to have, getting to know this thing, getting to hold it in our hands, getting to feel it very, very deeply, and then to move on. It's very important to move on. A society that stays traumatized by September 11th is a society that hasn't got through that deeper knowing. We now, as I say, need good public policy. The country has got some huge decisions to make about whether this war in Iraq is wise. We need to listen to the arguments. We need to treat each other with civility. We don't need to shout about this. This is too important to start screaming at each other. We need to think carefully what we owe the people we lost. We need to think carefully what the country stands for. We need to take a long, deep breath before we head into another military conflict.
One of the people whose position puts him in the state of having to take that long, deep breath on behalf of all of us is the person who's appointed on a semi-regular basis to be the Poet Laureate of the United States. And Billy Collins is on the line. He's been listening in. Hi, Billy.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Last fall, when we spoke, you hadn't written anything about September 11th, and you said at that time, if I remember correctly, that maybe a shadow will cross the page.
Well, that's you have a dangerous memory. I did say that because I really didn't feel up to the task. I thought to write about something so monumental and of such historical scale, you know, you're tempted to kind of speak beyond your own authority. And my poems tend to be, as many lyric poems do, tend to be more personal and quieter reflections. But I finally did write a poem about a month ago, which is a kind of elegy for the victims. But it took a long time to come to that point where I could.
Was it out of a sense of wanting to express something personal about that, or was it out of a sense of larger responsibility?
Well, the truth is a third choice, which is I was actually under a certain kind of congressional pressure to write something. I mean, I had a little kind of water pistol put to my head, and Congress asked me if I'd read something before that joint session in New York. And I still didn't have a poem. That was about a month ago. And I said, I will read some Whitman or I'll find something appropriate. But in the intervening days, feeling that pressure, I thought, well, maybe it's possible to write something that's true to me and to the event. And so I work well when I have an assignment like that.
Michael, you go back into the classroom tomorrow.
Yes.
You will have to make something of a shift from you know, your opportunity to discuss this with us and the assignment that Billy Collins refers to you to a different year, a change in the subject.
Well, this time last year, I walked into the classroom as the first plane hit and came out to do a second class when the second plane hit, and all I can remember is that we stood in silence. Try to remember those who had just that moment died. So I'm hoping this year that teaching will be in a somewhat calmer place. But what the poet so rightly said seems to me very good advice to all of us. We should not speak beyond our own authority. I'm going to plaster that up on my wall. It's very important that we get back and do our jobs and do them right. And as a teacher, I just got to do my job right. And I think every American will be trying to do that, do the job right, and above all, not speak of things we do not know and do not speak beyond our authority.
Good Lord, you'd close down all the talk radio shows in America. Michael, thanks for coming in.
Pleasure.
Nice to have you here. And Billy, do you have a copy of the poem there? Can I ask you to read it for us?
I do indeed. Yes, it's called The Names, and it's an elegy for the victims of September 11th. Yesterday, I lay awake in the palm of the night. A fine rain stole in, unhelped by any breeze, and when I saw the silver glaze on the windows, I started with A, with Ackerman, as it happened, then Baxter and Calabro, Davis and Eberling, names falling into place as droplets fell through the dark. Names printed on the ceiling of the night, names slipping around a watery bend, 26 willows on the banks of a stream. In the morning, I walked out barefoot among thousands of flowers, heavy with dew like the eyes of tears, and each had a name, Fiore inscribed on a yellow petal, then Gonzales and Hahn, Ishikawa and Jenkins. Names written in the air and stitched into the cloth of the day, a name under a photograph taped to a mailbox, monogram on a torn shirt. I see you spelled out on storefront windows and on the bright unfurled awnings of this city. I say the syllables as I turn a corner, Kelly and Lee, Medina, Nardella, and O'Connor. When I peer into the woods, I see a thick tangle where letters are hidden as in a puzzle concocted for children, Parker and Quigley in the twigs of an ash, Rizzo, Schubert, Torres, and Upton, secrets in the boughs of an ancient maple. Names written in the pale sky, names rising in the updraft amid buildings, names silent in stone or cried out behind a door, names blown over the earth and out to sea. In the evening, weakening light, the last swallows, a boy on a lake lifts his oars, a woman by a window puts a match to a candle, and the names are outlined on the rose clouds, Vanacore and Wallace. Let X stand, if it can, for the ones unfound. than Young and Zeminsky, the final jolt of Z. Names etched on the head of a pin, one name spanning a bridge, another undergoing a tunnel, a blue name needled into the skin. Names of citizens, workers, mothers and fathers, the bright-eyed daughter, the quick son. Alphabet of names in green rows in a field. Names in the small tracks of birds. Names lifted from a hat or balanced on the tip of the tongue. Names wheeled into the dim warehouse of memory. So many names, there is barely room on the walls of the heart.
That's Billy Collins, Poet Laureate of the United States, reading a poem he wrote. It's called The Names. It makes you think what it is about names. You think of the Vietnam Memorial, you think of the recitation of names at Yad Vashem that gives them so much power, Billy.
I think so. I mean, it's really, you see it on everything from the Vietnam War Memorial to those lest we forget monuments in small towns in America with the names of victims of the wars.
Even on cenotaphs in places where miners have died and memorials.
Well, I think it's a way of personalizing, at the same time ritualizing an event that's almost too big to get your arms around.
Thanks for being with us, Billy.
Thank you for having me.
Connection listeners, we end our program today by listening to the names as they are being read, or as they were read earlier in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, the tolling of the bell at that place where the aircraft went down.
Marion Britton. Thomas E. Burnett, Jr. William Cashman. Georgine Rose Corrigan. Patricia Cushing. Joseph DeLuca. Patrick Joe Driscoll. Edward Porter Felt. Jane C. Folger. Colleen L. Fraser. Andrew Garcia. Jeremy Glick.
I'm Dick Gordon. This has been special coverage from The Connection, Grand-Colas. National Public Radio.
Donald F. Green.